Jam.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. At the end of November, President Obama acted on something he promised to do from the start of his administration, take a stab at immigration reform. He said he'd do it with or without Congress, and apparently decided that the only way he could do anything was without them, and so he acted by executive order. In a nutshell, that order cracks down on illegal immigration while prioritizing the deportation of felons over families, and requires certain undocumented immigrants to pass a criminal background check and pay taxes in order to temporarily stay in this country without fear of deportation. Republicans don't like this one bit. Democrats cautiously accepted it, and at least one federal judge has called this executive order unconstitutional. So this hour, we'll take a closer look at the order, at what it says, who it affects, what impact it might have, and at whether or not it may be unconstitutional. We're joined by Alan Gordon, an Immigration Law Board certified attorney in private practice. He was also selected in 2006 to serve as chairman of the Mayor's Immigration Study Commission, which researches policies, gathers data, and analyzes the impact of legal and illegal immigration on the economy, safety, health care, and on education. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Dr. Greg Weeks is back with us. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte, whose research interests include Latin American politics, relations, and immigration to the United States. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
The president has recently taken a couple of actions with regard to Latin America, this immigration rule, and of course, just days ago, very surprisingly, announced the resumption of the impending resumption of diplomatic relations with Cuba. Why both? Why now? And are they in any way related? Dr. Weeks.
The answer is, I think, yeah, they are related. I think that particularly as President Obama was looking toward the end of his term and was going to be entering lame duck status, he had these issues that had been stuck for a long time, and he figured that really this is the only opportunity he's going to have a legacy on some pretty major issues. And I think he figured if Republicans weren't going to budge, then he was just going to bust it wide open.
Are both of these things that only a lame duck president can afford to do?
Well, I think it makes it easier. I don't know that you couldn't do it before, but
well, if you're going to get reelected, you might have a problem.
Oh, certainly. Well, right. Well, maybe or maybe not. Maybe or maybe not. But, yeah, it makes it a lot easier for him because he's looking at legacy. He's not looking at election.
Does the timing of this surprise you? I mean, we've been talking, Alan, you and I have been on this show, I can't count the number of times, talking about immigration with local cases of immigration and the national picture of immigration, and you and many other guests on this program have said for years that the U.S. immigration policy is completely and totally broken and needs to be scrapped and rewritten from the get-go, and we need to do it soon and sooner than later because it's affecting not only national security but the economy.
Right.
So why now?
Well, I think it had to happen now because he had waited long enough. A lot of people were upset that he waited too long. The demographics are getting more and more obvious that the baby boomers are doing, like I've said in previous shows, doing one of two things, or they're doing two things. They're getting older and they're dying. And on the way to that, they're leaving the workforce and the birth rate is not replacement. In North Carolina, for instance, Dr. James Johnson out of Kenan Flagler at UNC has a great report on saying, you know, the beauty of demographics is if you're 5 years old now, 5 years from now, you'll be 10.
And no question.
No questions there. It's so much unlike immigration law. So what we have is we have a decreasing workforce. We have a lot of old people that are going to need more help and more financial help. If we don't fix the economy and look for workers and look what's going on in the world and look what's made North Carolina strong economically and with production manufacturing, specialty manufacturing, we're not going to go back to the 40s and 50s and 60s here. So it really is time that, you know, somebody stands up and has the courage to take some immigration reform action.
And we'll talk more about jobs a little bit later on, but there will be people out there who heard what you just said about we need people to come in and take these jobs from retiring and dying baby boomers. saying, well, there are people wanting for jobs all over the country. The job recovery is just really now – it's just really now recovered. People are still looking for jobs. So why do we need more people if people here already don't have jobs?
Oddly enough, it's becoming more and more obvious with statistics that there's certain jobs that Americans, native-born Americans, don't want to do. And the other side of the coin, which I think is a good thing, is that it's becoming very clear that the reason people come to the United States is either for jobs, for work, or for safety and security. You know, things are going horrible in my country. It's time to come here. Again, I've always said that if it's bad here, it's worse there, and they want to come here. And that's what's good about the United States. We are a magnet to the world for safety and opportunity. And that's why we have entrepreneurs, and that's why we invent stuff.
We're going to spend the hour talking about immigration, but this Cuba thing just happened. And I know, Dr. Weeks, you've been interviewed repeatedly on television about this. This is kind of your bailiwick. There's a lot of hue and cry in the Cuban community in the United States, particularly in Miami, which is, Little Havana, because most of the people who came here in the 50s settled there. It's close enough to Cuba, 90 miles. There's been condemnation by Florida Senator Marco Rubio over this approach. He's called it naive and stupid and other things. Are the people who are against this executive order on immigration the same as those who would be against the normalization of relations with Cuba? Do those who favor the executive order also favor the normalization of relations with Cuba? Or is it all over the board?
You mean the connection between immigration and Cuba?
If I'm against the immigration executive order, would I also be against the normalization of relations? Or might I be in two different camps?
No, you can actually be in two different camps. There are some people who are adamantly opposed to opening up to Cuba, but they are adamantly in favor of immigration reform. And what they see is Cuba as a separate case. And they want a continuation of current Cuba immigration because Cuba is in its own special category where if you make it to the United States, you have a path to residency immediately.
Well, before we started, you talked about this wet foot, dry foot law that we have where if you get here from Cuba, as long as you make land, you can stay. You can get a green card.
Right.
If you don't make land, if they pick you up in the ocean, you're going back.
You're going back. That's right.
If you normalize relations, if you open up air travel, if you open up commerce, one of the things I heard talked about yesterday about this was that they hope that Cuban baseball players can come to the United States and play without having to defect. But there might be a bunch of people who come here just because they want to come here. Will this cause a greater immigration problem, illegal immigration problem, once we open the doors?
Well, there part of the negotiation between the U.S. and Cuba has been that in early 2015 there's going to be renewed immigration discussions. The wet foot, dry foot policy probably is going to have to go away because if you have increased air travel, then you're actually facilitating
dry foot,
in a way that really hasn't been the case in many years. And that whole part of a Cuba immigration policy is going to have to change. Mm-hmm. As a baseball fan, I hope they open up Cuba to U.S. baseball, but we'll have to see.
In his speech regarding the executive order that he was taking to fix immigration, or at least a partial fix of immigration, the president said, today our immigration system is broken. It's been said on this program 1,000 times by 1,000 different people. People in the Congress have said it. Republicans in the Congress who are against this order have said it. Why does nobody act upon it? Why did it take an executive order that he knew would cause ruffle feathers? Why did it take that to make anything at all happen?
Well, the sad reality of our system is that everybody wants to get reelected once they get elected, or they want to just first get elected. They want to raise money and for elections. So it's very unpopular, or at least it becomes very expensive, to fight the forces that don't want to fix immigration, or they want to fix things in a different order. Mm-hmm. Like, we have spent millions and millions of dollars on the southern border. But what we found was in the recession of 2008, the number of immigrants coming into the United States greatly decreased because there weren't jobs. So that really proved it.
And one thing I wanted to add, too, about getting elected is that particularly if you're talking about primaries, if you're talking about other elections where turnout is low, then you got to toss red meat to your base. Mm-hmm. And that base is a minority voice, but if that base has tremendous power, that actually relates to Cuba policy too.
You're a political scientist, so let's just spend 2 seconds talking about this. It seems we can't have any adult conversations about any single topic at the government level in this country anymore. Is it the primary system? Is it the way we do business in the primaries where you have to play to your base to get to the general election, and then you can modify? But if you modify too much, they'll skewer you the next time around, and you won't get reelected. Is that the problem?
That's a big part of the problem. If you just look
at— Is there a solution to that? How new is this problem? Was this the case in the 1800s, the early 1900s?
No, because you're going to have – you have much more participation now. Actually, back then probably it could be easier to change things because you had about 2% of the population that was actually participating. But if you continue to have a primary system as we do now, mm-hmm. then this isn't going to go away because – What Republicans have had to do was to go very far to the right on immigration and other issues and primaries, and then try to find some sort of middle-ish ground later to try, because the general population is actually not as extreme as the base.
So does the president's action actually, when you remove all the harumphing and the brouhaha, does it actually make life easier for Republicans? They don't have to take action. It's already been done.
I think it does. I think it gives them the opportunity to just point fingers and dodge, you know, they think they're dodging a bullet and they say it's his fault, but gee, I guess we'll go ahead and make the economy strong, you know, and then they'll take credit for that. So he did it. He's lame duck. He can do a lot of stuff now that he couldn't have done before. He does need to create history.
There's a threat on the table that they'll defund something, some department.
They wanted to defund USCIS, but
right.
they know better. They say that, but that is funded by the application form filing fees, so it's self-funded.
So prior to the president's executive action, what was the status of immigration reform? Was it moving at all anywhere with anyone?
No, it wasn't even spinning. It was just sitting. It was nowhere. And business immigration, you know, it really aggravated a lot of big business people that put together a lobbying organization to fix immigration law from the business point of view, like H-1B visas. There's not enough of them, and it pumps up the economy to have more of them. And the only reason employers would go for an H-1B is because they can't get what they want in the local American market. So they spend thousands of dollars on filing fees and taxes and things that the government put into the system, and they go through a long process, and it becomes a lottery process, and maybe they win an H-1B. But the little employers in North Carolina, the ones that aren't looking for 100 H-1B professional workers, they want one, and they can't get one because they're competing with IBM, Intel, mm-hmm. Microsoft, Apple, whatever.
Does this order help that?
No, it doesn't, and that's why the big companies were so upset. Is like, what happened to business immigration reform, which should be an easy fix? It's not religion.
And that
it's not politics.
That would be up the Republicans' alley, would it not?
I thought so, yes.
Yeah, you would think so, but I assume that the idea of changing the quotas, they figure, is going to get wrapped up into issues that they don't want to have to deal with. And so it's easier to just punt on it now and avoid having to actually vote favorably on undocumented immigrants.
We're going to take a look at what the executive order does point by point when we come back, and then later on we'll talk about the constitutionality of this particular action and executive orders in general. They've been taken by every president known to man, I think, in recent modern times at least. We're with Alan Gordon, an immigration attorney, and Dr. Greg Weeks, chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his latest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Sedaris visits the Belk Theater April 20th with all new readings and recollections. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Tis the season to be jolly. It's also gift-giving season, a time to give back as well. And we have all those bases covered as we explore some locally curated gift guides on Monday. In case you are stumped for a last-minute gift, perhaps we can come to the rescue on Monday, and then we'll get some suggestions on opportunities to give back in these waning days of 2014. That's all Monday morning at 9, right here.
On the next Day and Ream show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama announces an historic shift in U.S.-Cuba relations, Sony cancels release of the movie The Interview, and Jeb Bush announces he's exploring a possible presidential run.
Join the News Roundup on the Day and Ream show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're with Alan Gordon, immigration attorney, Alan Gordon, immigration law, and Dr. Greg Weeks, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. We're talking about immigration reform and specifically about the president's recent executive order, which does very specific things. Let's take them one by one. It gives three-year deferrals to undocumented migrants who have U.S.-born children who are citizens or legal residents or who have been in the United States since 2010. That seems highly specific to me. It affects about 4 million people, I understand. And Dr. Weeks, you say this excludes parents of dreamers. Explain that.
Well, what the president has said is that he couldn't expand his authority to actually include the parents because it was essentially one person removed, so that you weren't making it wasn't one away from a citizen, and so it was getting too far removed, and that meant that he didn't have the authority, only Congress would have the authority to make that argument.
What I just read off this order is that migrants who have U.S.-born children. And U.S.-born children are automatically citizens of the United States, aren't they? Okay. And who have been in the U.S. since 2010 gives them they can stay in the country for 3 years. Is that what the order says, essentially? What happens after 3 years? You have to go?
Yeah, or this is going to have to be renewed.
So what if your child is 12? They have to go with you? They're citizens. They don't have to go. What happens to them?
Oh, well, then that gets wrapped up in the court system.
Well, they don't have to go. I mean, they could actually stay here, but the question is, how do they get to stay here? Who will they stay with?
Right.
Will they become wards of the state? Is there a relative that'll take over? But more importantly, I mean, what they're saying is we're going to expand what used to be what we called DACA was for the kids that came here before they were 16 illegally. They were brought with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so we gave DACA kids now 3 years of the right to be here and the right to work, which is great. And my son's got, kids like that in school with them. And these are kids that have gone, lived in the United States. In many cases, they've done all their school here.
Right. They're Americans.
They're Americans.
Going home would be like going to a foreign country.
Exactly. But they're not, they're not U.S. citizens.
Right.
So they should be helped. So this gives them 3 years, but yes,
but
it could disappear.
But this is for kids who are citizens.
No, now we're saying the parents of a U.S. citizen or the parent of a lawful permanent resident.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we're going to help the parents of a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident by giving them 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they have a clean criminal record.
Isn't this just kicking the can down the road?
Sure.
Yeah, but what I think the idea is that once the country sees that this is actually something that's not catastrophic, that doesn't somehow change our whole way of life, and that it actually helps people, that there's going to be more pressure on Congress to do something permanently in the next 3 years.
What happens to these people right now or the minutes before that executive order was issued? What was happening to those people?
Well, actually, it's going to take for the parents, it'll probably take 6 months before we have regulations and forms that we can file. So we're telling everybody, don't pay money to anybody to do something that doesn't it's not available yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll take a few months for this.
But, before this executive order, granting 3 extra years to people like this, if we found them, did we then deport them?
Well, they were put into removal, but a lot of ICE officers already figured they were a low priority, so they weren't really looking for these people. They weren't looking for people that just were overstays or just illegally here.
Or, I mean, I've served as expert witness, and what they would do, they'd be at immigration court and make a case for why, you know, if they're – if you know, about what should happen to their children, because their children are you can't deport me because my child's going to be sent back to Honduras, which has the highest homicide rate in the world, or whatever the case might be. So they were absolutely vulnerable. Mm. What this does is give them a really – pretty massively increased sense of security for a short amount of time.
Okay. The act allows deferred action for the parents of these children who have been here less than 5 years, who can pass a background check and who will pay taxes to stay. Aren't they paying taxes already? I mean, if they're day workers, aren't they getting wages that are automatically deducting taxes and Social Security payments that they will never see?
A lot of them have been paying taxes, and a lot of them have been proud to tell lawyers, yes, we pay taxes. I have an ITIN. I have an individual taxpayer ID number. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, the employer withholds taxes, and it goes to a make-pretend Social Security number. There's billions and billions of dollars that Social Security has in unmatched funds because of that.
So they just make up a Social Security number?
Or? Right. It's been going on for a long, long time.
So could they be credit? If they choose my number, could they be crediting my account?
They could be. You should check that.
Will the people that this provision helps be difficult to find? Will they feel that they can, with some security, come forward?
I think they're going to feel that they can come. I want people to come forward and get in this program because I want like Greg had said, we want to show that there's a lot of people that can be helped, and yet it doesn't turn the country upside down, mm-hmm. and that it's a good thing, and that people should feel safe here. That's one of the reasons that people came to the United States, and that's why a lot of us are happy to be here and stay here.
But I think it's going to take a lot of outreach because the numbers that this is estimated to help – that doesn't mean that all of these people are going to get helped because you need to have grassroots organizations. You need to have people who are saying, hey, look, here's what you have to do. Here's what you can do. Because then a lot of other people might not even really know or be too afraid to take advantage of it.
So these people who have children who were born in this country, who are therefore automatically U.S. citizens, and whether they're one or they're 17, after 3 years, they face deportation. The parents face deportation. And if they have a minor child who is a U.S. citizen, given the fact that for 3 years this order has been in place, does that set some sort of legal precedent to help them, if nothing else happens, after the 3 years is over?
I don't know that it sets a precedent, but what it does is it gives a track record that the person could go into court and there may be more case development or statutory development, who knows, where there'll be more benefits available for the parents, to get, hardship waivers or something. But right now, it's a temporary program, and it's not going to fix the long term, but it can lead to this kind of work.
And what will the impact of this executive order be on these DACA kids, these Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program children who came here with their parents? They're not citizens, but they've lived almost their entire lives here. Their conscious lives have been lived in America, in American schools. They are American. They speak English. They know American history. They know nothing about Honduran history, perhaps, or very little about it. What happens to them under this? How are they affected at all, if at all?
Well, the good news is that they can get 3 years instead of just 2 years to be here, to work here. They can go on and, they're out of the shadows. They're allowed
they want
to be here.
But do they want to be out of the shadows? Particularly these people, do they want to be out of the shadows when there's a sunset on this?
Well, I think the kids want to be out of the shadows. I think they'd like to see it as a permanent fix to the law by Congress.
Isn't there a danger of coming out of the shadows? If 3 years from now there's a Republican president in the White House and he wants to cancel that order, he can do it like that.
Yeah, I was on a television interview, and I think that would be a really horrible thing for the United States Congress to do, would be to take away a benefit.
Well, we've done some horrible things in our history.
Well, I know, and a lot of them are related to immigration. But I would be hoping that if something like that was even talked about, that a lot of people that, you know, we used to call the silent majority would stand up and make a lot of noise, because it would be atrocious.
And I agree. I think that coming back to demography, which Alan had mentioned before, is that you have a political angle to demography as well, and that is the growing importance of the Latino electorate. So let's say from 3 years from 2015, you're talking about sort of a midterm of a new president. Let's say it's a Republican president. They're going to have to alienate this electorate if they're going to yank all of the things that President Obama has just announced. And there's a really significant political danger to doing that. And I think that combined with a popular pressure not to do so, there's going to be a political pressure that, hey, we better think of some other solution, because otherwise we're wiping out for the near future a big chunk of voters.
I also wanted to mention that when, like Greg was saying, but when they turned 21, not only when they turned 21, if the kids were born in the United States at the age of 21, they can petition for their moms and dads. So as a U.S. citizen, you have to wait until you're 21, and that's what they used to, you know, that's what they call the anchor babies. That's the 21-year immigration plan that we talk to people about.
I want to come back to the politics of this, because there's undoubtedly politics involved in this. The executive order also expands the DREAM Act to people over 30. It maintains the DREAM Act and expands it from 2 to 3 years. We already talked about this. This is very confusing for me. Both these provisions impact about 1.5 million people. Have we already talked about the DREAM Act provisions?
Yeah, I mean, and those are estimates. Some that, like the White House has provided, they're general estimates. But yes, there's all kinds of confusing parts of it. Alan probably knows much better. Mm-hmm. But overall, the way I understand it, it could affect potentially about 6 million people.
Okay. Wow. One of the things that I mentioned in the open of this program, that this order focuses on enforcement on felons over families. I think the president put that in his speech.
Yes, he did.
Which is very carefully worded, it seems to me, because family values and going after criminals and not people who are law-abiding except for the fact that they're here illegally. The action also focuses more attention on the border. By how much? Is there money for that? Aren't we already focusing attention on the border? Haven't we already beefed up security on the border to the point where we can't afford it anymore? What does this act do that we haven't been doing already in that area?
It's not specific as to what it's doing. I mean, we have added a lot of people and a lot of equipment, a lot of biometrics, a lot of night vision stuff. So,
has it worked?
I think it's worked in a lot of ways.
Has it worked, or is it simply the fact that we've been in recession for 6 or 7 years and people don't come here because there are not jobs for them?
Well, a lot of people think that nobody's getting removed, but under President Obama, about 424,000 people were deported. So a lot more than under under either the President Bush's. So, you know, a lot of people are getting deported. The borders are catching lots of people. They're able to do it now with a lot more electronic surveillance instead of just people riding horses, which used to be the old school. And so I think the enforcement has increased. There's a lot of money going into it. And they're saying they're going to put more money into it. But the real question is, you know, When you take away just looking at just the southern border, and nobody ever talks about the northern border as if it didn't exist, even though it's bigger.
Mm.
So the real question is, you know, I hate to say it, but business immigration, if the economy was a lot stronger, then we wouldn't be so upset about things.
Deportations under the President Obama are up 80%, 80% over his predecessor, and yet he is criticized for being soft on immigration. Why?
Because they really dislike President Obama. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. What we put into the border is pretty much absurd. I mean, billions and billions of dollars, lots of it wasted.
And why did he do it?
To throw a bone. I mean, and that's why that's also in here, to throw a bone. Everything is about security first, border first. He can say, look, here it is, border first. I'm spending gobs of money on the border, and that's what you wanted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's really it. And I think at this point, too, part of the reason that he was that he pushed this executive action was because it is absolutely impossible to seal the border unless you have a Berlin Wall. And short of a Berlin Wall, it is impossible to tell somebody, hey, there is no single person that's going to make it through.
It is also, as he said, impossible to track down, round up, and deport millions of people. He said he didn't say it was impossible. He said it wasn't realistic.
It's possible, and if you want to be like North Korea. Otherwise, realistically, no, it's impossible.
Well, they also said it would take about $285 billion mm-hmm. to remove 11 million people at about $12,500 a piece. And $185 billion.
And then who would cut the White House lawn? It also, this act, its action also encourages high-skilled workers, entrepreneurs, and the like by streamlining the current immigration system and making it easier to navigate, makes it easier to get a visa. When we think about immigrants, and I was making a joke, but it's true, we think about people who come here and they work in jobs that, quote-unquote, Americans will not take, don't want to do, like landscape work, cutting the yard, painting houses, doing grunt work, working in kitchens, places like that. But you're taught this act makes provisions for entrepreneurs and high-skilled workers. Does that not threaten American jobs if you're a high-skilled worker or if you're an entrepreneur and you're coming here to do something that you couldn't do in your home country but you're going to do it here?
Well, the statistics are pretty clear that the entrepreneurial side of the economy creates jobs for others. So it creates jobs for Native Americans, meaning, Americans that were born here.
So what skills are missing? What skills do we need? Because you alluded to this earlier. What skills are big business and smaller business looking for that they cannot find here? And why can't they find them here?
Well, a lot of – let's go back for a second to entrepreneurs. I mean, this is a special kind of person. This is somebody that they might be living anywhere in the world where it's extremely hard to start your own business. And in the United States, it turns out it's really pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have started businesses that have been very successful here. So when foreign investors or foreign people come to the United States and start a business, the first thing they do is hire locals to make sure that they're doing things properly in our community and our society as far as accounting and things like that, mm-hmm. And dealing with vendors. And they go on and they grow and they prosper, and more Americans are directly and indirectly employed through that. So entrepreneurs are a good thing. When it comes to what other skills there are, I mean, give an example, several years ago when there was software that came in from Europe and it was being used by all the German-speaking companies, but nobody over here had learned it in the universities in their IT programs, so we had to bring in IT technologists that already knew that software because the software was created over there as opposed to in here.
Right.
Now, we do at the same time, we create things here and we send people around the world. Oddly enough, we grew up hearing, oh, it's a global economy. It's going to be a real global economy world. And now it is, and it's like the American immigration law does not reflect it at all. The former mayor of Charlotte used to say, we have all these foreign-owned businesses that employ all these Americans here in Mecklenburg County and this region of North Carolina, and we're blessed with it. But then they talk about immigration, and they only talk about people cutting grass or eviscerating chickens or cleaning fish down at the coast or things like that. And that is part of immigration. But the real part of immigration in the growth side of the economy is new and better businesses and inventors and entrepreneurs and things like that.
And I want to talk about something that you've talked about on this program before when we come back from the break, and that is the brain drain that we've had where kids come here, they learn at our schools, and then we send them away because their student visa has expired and we're just tossing away these people that we've educated. Does this act address that? We'll find out when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Foundation for the Carolinas Levine Conference Center, offering convening space for corporate events, retreats, board meetings, and meeting space for our region's nonprofits. Information at fftc.org. You know how I know it's Friday? Because today is the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the national hour first, the international hour at 11 o'clock. In that first hour, President Obama announces an historic shift in U.S.-Cuba relations. They'll be talking about that. They'll be talking about Sony canceling its release of the movie The Interview, and Jeb Bush announcing a possible exploratory look at becoming a presidential candidate. Those stories and more in the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
When you make contributions to the organizations that are important to you this time of year, consider WFAE. Listener support is the heart and soul of WFAE, and your year-end gift will help pay for the programs you depend on. Contribute online at WFAE.org by December 21st, and you'll be entered to win an Apple iPad Mini. No pledge is necessary to win, but we hope you'll help keep WFAE strong in 2015.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the president's recent executive order. I keep calling it an act. It is not an act. It is an executive action or an executive order about immigration. Alan Gordon is with us, an immigration attorney, and Dr. Greg Weeks, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte, whose expertise in research is Latin American politics, relations, and immigration. We've talked on this program in the past about the brain drain that we experience here. We allow students to come in. We educate them in areas that are highly skilled and require great brain power and expertise, and then because their student visas expire, we send them home, as opposed to allowing them to stay here and helping us to benefit from their expertise. Does this executive order address that at all?
Well, it specifically comes out and says that we should tell the U.S. ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, that they're the ones that run the student program after 9/11. Mm-hmm. So it says that practical training should be looked at and maybe expanded. So, you know, again, the president's trying to fix business immigration without having Congress to actually do what needs to be done. Mm. So he says, well, let them stay longer on practical training after they finish their program. Most of these young people that are educated here, whether they get a bachelor's, a master's, or a PhD, they'd like to stay in this country. They ask to stay in this country, and it's the law that says you can only stay here for your practical training, and then you must leave, or you can continue in school and be a student some more and pay money for being a student. There's companies that would like to keep them here, and they do the H-1B program, but they can't get an H-1B.
Is this an unintended consequence of legislation, or is this something that was deliberate or written for a different time?
I'd like to be generous and say it was written for a different time, but the H-1B numbers, it used to be around 200,000 H-1Bs, and there was enough of them for all the American employers to get the foreign nationals that they wanted, which they had to pay prevailing wage and they had to pay government filing fees and things like that. They were not getting them on the cheap. But the student visa situation, it goes back to, I think, the 50s and 60s, where we said, come over here and see that democracy is a wonderful thing, and then we'll make you go home, and you can spread the word, and it's kind of like you're our emissaries back in your country, telling everybody what a wonderful time you had and how great democracy is. Mm. And that's actually what happened. And there's countries, there's people all over the world that are really excited when they meet an American, and they have never perhaps met any Americans. And it's because somebody from their community had been over here to go to school long ago. Mm. Maybe it was an uncle.
You mentioned the baby boomers are retiring and dying, and therefore we need people to take jobs. But what about the millennials? What about the Gen Xers who are also trying to move up the ladder and take the place of baby boomers? Are there not enough of them in numbers?
I don't think there's enough of any of them. And, you know, and again, one of the things that the studies have shown, the demographic studies, is that Americans that were born here really feel that they should be able to do certain kinds of jobs and occupations and not others. And they just don't want to do chicken eviscerating, or they don't want to do fish cleaning and things like that. So you're always going to have jobs until the entire world gets mechanized. I can remember when Sue Myrick said, you know, we're going to grow square tomatoes so that they can be picked by machines. We won't need people. Well, until that happens, you know, and strawberries are even tougher to pick with a machine because they crush.
In his speech, President Obama said, "The actions I'm taking are not only lawful, they're the kinds of actions taken by every single Republican president and every single Democratic president for the past half century." So he's among a long line of presidents who have taken various actions by executive order. What types of actions, Dr. Weeks, have they historically been?
Well, on immigration, they have. Both Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. had taken actions that expanded the numbers for immigration for family fairness, so that unintentional parts of the law forced families to be separated. And so they took action unilaterally to address that so these families wouldn't be broken up. So there's plenty of precedent for that. Perhaps not at the same scope as what we're seeing now in terms of how many people it would affect, but there's clearly precedent.
Is the power of executive order in the Constitution?
Well, you have to – it's all about executing the laws faithfully.
Is it mentioned in the Constitution by – it's not mentioned by name, is it?
Well, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but yes, there is about faithfully executing laws, but exactly how all of that is going to happen is completely open to interpretation.
So in other words, the executive branch executes the laws of the country, but and if it requires an executive order to get something done, that would make it constitutional. But if there are laws on the books about immigration and this executive order goes against those laws or alters those laws, is that executing the law? Is it constitutional?
I think it is constitutional.
Why?
Because there will be a law that says that it's a crime if you're here without permission, and then the next question is, okay, so are we going to enforce this law against everyone and spread out our resources, or are we going to be realistic and look at our resources and decide how the executive branch is immigration arm or Social Security or what have you is going to use their limited resources to enforce the law?
Well, we've had examples of attorneys general deciding to not enforce laws that are on the book, either because they're unenforceable or they feel that they will soon be overturned. But aren't you opening the door to anarchy? I mean, we pride ourselves on the rule of law in this country. If there's a law in the books that says something, aren't you supposed to follow it, whether you have the resources or not?
Well, I mean, you could say that about, jaywalking. You can argue either way. You could say all jaywalkers should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, or you should say, there's some things that are a lot more important to public safety than jaywalking, so we're going to kind of let jaywalking slide down a little bit on the pecking order, and we're going to go after violent criminals, rapists, and robbers, and drug dealers, and things like that. They've done that in immigration law. They said, look, instead of spending time getting the easy catch, which is just following kids home from school and busting their parents, let's, look at foreign nationals that are here illegally that are involved in sex trade or drugs or violent things, and let's focus our resources on the really bad people in the society.
Executive orders emanate from the executive branch and the head of the executive branch, the sitting president. So when the next president comes in, if that next president is a Republican and Republicans don't like this, they could, with the stroke of a pen, end it, which could throw people into turmoil here. It's certainly likely, is it not, that this will become a rallying cry during the election season?
Oh, absolutely it will. And President Obama is counting on the fact that it will be popular enough that Republicans will not be in a good position to be able to reverse it. But I would absolutely expect that this Cuba, too, is going to come into it. You're going to hear a lot about President Obama being an emperor and a king and a tyrant. And so, so gear up for that, because it's not going to stop for the next couple years.
And it could be overturned by a Republican president, but would that be a politically wise thing to do? Isn't this kind of like the Affordable Care Act? If you get enough people to sign up for health insurance who didn't have health insurance in the past, and then you say, we're taking this away from you, that becomes politically unfeasible. Is the same thing going to happen here? But these people are not citizens, so would it matter?
Well, they have friends and family that are voters or potential voters, so it should matter.
And you have a lot of Americans who maybe don't have relatives who are involved, but say, I don't really want to do this to people. And so once it's in place, it's going to be a lot harder to take it away.
Plus, if Republicans, we keep hearing pundits say that Republicans need to court the Hispanic Latino vote, if they act in a way that slaps them in the face, that's political suicide, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think actually in addition to hearing sniping from the parties is that you're going to see a lot of dissension within the Republican Party itself.
You already do.
About whether to reverse this in the future.
Okay. Doctor, you point out that if this order is allowed to stand during this final 2 years of the Obama presidency, the 3 years of deferral goes into effect next year. It will expire in 2018 and become a midterm political hot potato. So is the three-year term, was it set up by President Obama deliberately to make it so?
He could have said 4 years.
That's a
good question.
He could have said 2 years. He could have said 5 years, but he said three.
He did say three, and he moved the DREAM Act from two to three. So, I mean, it's entirely possible, yeah.
Did he set it up? Did he set the stage for Latino support for the Democratic presidential candidate in the next election?
Yes, because that was something that was starting to flag, is that Latino population was saying, you talk and talk and talk, and you just don't do anything. Mm-hmm. You are the deporter in chief. And this was another important thing that he had to do in order to give Democrats a better shot in 2016.
He went on to say in his speech about this order, to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill. Was that meant to diffuse criticism or was it meant to be a challenge?
Well, I think it was definitely a challenge. I was, you know, instead of just picking it. See, what we're doing right now is talking a lot about, you know, should we have more and more lawsuits by states like North Carolina and others to say that the law is unconstitutional, not the law, but his action is unconstitutional. So it's, you know, we're not really addressing the issue. We're just talking a lot and having a lot of press talk, mm-hmm. television time, radio time about, you know, is it constitutional? How did he do it? Is he the king? You know, and really the issue is, gee, aren't we still getting older? Aren't we still, you know, the birth rates aren't going to change over the next few months. They've been the way they are for years. So, the future of this nation really needs to be looked at, and immigration policy is not just has to reflect that we're a nation of laws and freedom and, you know, we welcome creative people and entrepreneurs, but it also has got to fix immigration.
Well, we say we do welcome those people, but we want them to come in through channels, jumping through the hoops that we set up to keep things legal. But what I've heard you and others on this program over the years saying, and you can chime in on this too, Dr. Weeks, is that the hoops we set up don't work. They don't work for us. They don't work for immigrants. The people who are trying to get in here legally wait for years and years and years and years and years, 14, 15, 16, 17 years, and they can't get in.
Well, that is true, but I think you could use a simpler example. H-1Bs is a temporary worker, maximum 6 years. They're professionals. You have to go through hoops and hurdles, but the spouse can't work. So if you have an option of going here with your spouse that cannot work, you go from a two-income family to a one, mm-hmm. or you can get to go to Germany or Switzerland or Austria or Canada or England. If they offer your spouse work authorization, then you stay a two-income family, you go there. These are simple fixes. These are not rocket science. These are just, does the United States really want to pay attention to what they're telling creative people, the people that we say we want? Mm-hmm. Do we really want to make it so that they can come here, they can afford to come here and stay here? What this announcement says is we're going to look at the Department of Labor process. Well, the new thing that it's called PERM has been around for 10 years, and they said, well, everybody knows it doesn't work.
In the past, when parties and politicians did things that benefited immigration and immigrants, didn't they earn the trust, the confidence, and the votes of those people?
Yeah, just look at Latino support for the Republican Party not too terribly long ago. George W. Bush is already in a different planet than most Republicans with regard to immigration.
So what makes this so difficult for both parties? What makes this so difficult to work on, to fix?
I just think that the political environment has become so polarized that immigration gets sucked into it and common sense goes completely out the window.
There is the question – I'm going to go back to constitutionality because there's a question of this. Last week, a federal judge in Pennsylvania, U.S. District Court Judge Arthur Schwab, found parts of this action unconstitutional. He said it amounts to legislating from the executive branch and violates the separation of powers provided for in the Constitution as well as the Take Care Clause, which I have no idea what that is, but that makes it unconstitutional. He also cited the president's argument that he was proceeding with the action after Congress failed to act on comprehensive immigration legislation, saying that congressional inaction does not endow legislative power with the executive. Is he right on some or all of those points?
Well, the listener should be reminded that this is a district court case out of Western District of Pennsylvania. So it's the lowest level of court in the federal system. The issue was a DUI case. And this judge went and said, you know, he must decide whether or not the executive order was constitutional and went on and wrote page after page after page on it. So I still think that it is constitutional for the executive to act like an executive when it comes to his agencies. Mm-hmm. But that's not what he said. That's not what he decided.
Will this just be a hot potato that gets tossed around in the next 2 years as we warm up to the election, the presidential election? Or will this actually spur people, citizens, congresspeople, candidates to ask for and work on real immigration reform?
Well, I think there's going to be a time lag so that there might be people who say, okay, look, now is the time we really got to work on real reform. But if you just look at the timing with the presidential election, that weighs very heavily against seeing a major bill.
Will the Cuba diplomatic relation resumption, will that be a hot potato in the 2016 election, or will that just affect people in South Florida?
Yeah, I actually don't think it's going to be a major issue itself, except as an example of Obama acting too much in a unilateral fashion. Mm-hmm. I think most Americans are going to be excited about their cigars.
Which they're talking about a lot. Dr. Greg Weeks, a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte, and Alan Gordon, an immigration attorney with Alan Gordon Immigration Law Attorney. Not attorney, attorney with Alan Gordon Immigration Law. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank
Mike.
You.